Today is May 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up, North Korea tests an apparent short-range missile, raising concerns about nuclear negotiations.
South Korea's presidential office just released a statement saying it is very worried about the apparent short-range ballistic missile test. They said it does not help inter-Korean relations and military tensions.
Also ahead, we hear the latest on congressional efforts to learn more from Donald Trump Jr., son of the U.S. president, about testimony he gave to the U.S. Senate in 2017, and Europe says it will continue trade with Iran. It's all on today's International Edition. South Korea's military says North Korea has launched what appears to be two short-range missiles. The launch is the second time in less than 1 week that the North has carried out such a weapons test. South Korean officials said today that they are continuing to investigate the launch. North Korean state media called Saturday's launch self-defensive. The United States military showed its displeasure with the test by suspending a joint program with North Korea aimed at recovering the remains of U.S. service members killed during the Korean War. Yesterday, U.S. President Donald Trump may have added to questions about military cooperation on the Korean Peninsula. At an event in Florida, the president suggested that some allies are not contributing enough to their own defense. Although he did not name any country, some experts say he was talking about South Korea. To understand more about the situation, I asked VOA correspondent Bill Gallo this morning about the reaction in Seoul to the latest test.
South Korea's presidential office just released a statement not that long ago saying it is very worried about the apparent short-range ballistic missile test. They said it does not help inter-Korean relations and military tensions. Now, the notable thing about that is, once again, they said they are very concerned. They said the same thing last week after North Korea tested another short-range missile. They called this an apparent missile launch. These appear to have gone longer than the launch on Saturday, and there is no real plausible way to refer to these with the more peaceful-sounding projectile reference.
Is this going to hurt negotiations to end North Korea's nuclear weapons program? And where do talks stand now?
I think the major thing we are waiting for right now is Donald Trump's response. Donald Trump, for the past year, has consistently said that talks with Kim Jong-un are working, and his main evidence was that there were no North Korean nuclear or missile tests, and that there was a joint effort at remains recovery for remains from the Korean War. North Korea has now tested apparently three short-range missiles, and just yesterday the Pentagon said that they have suspended those remains recovery efforts. So it's very hard to sell this process as working. Much depends on how Donald Trump responds to this, but it's hard to see how he will be able to sort of shrug this one off.
Now, these are short-range missiles. Does this run afoul of United Nations sanctions on long-range missile tests?
That's a good question. And yes, if they are ballistic missiles, if it could be confirmed that they are ballistic missiles, there are United Nations sanctions which ban North Korea from any ballistic missile activity. Now, what this would not be is a violation, if you will, of Kim Jong-un's self-imposed suspension of intercontinental ballistic missile tests and nuclear tests. He said in April last year that he does not plan to test ICBMs or anything related to his nuclear test. Now, that was never formalized. This was never something that was signed in an agreement. There was no details about that. It's hard to really say it's a violation of something that was never really promised. However, it is more evidence that Kim Jong-un is looking to pressure Donald Trump to make progress on these nuclear talks that are stalled right now.
At a recent event in Florida, U.S. President Donald Trump suggested that allies are not contributing enough to their own defense. Some experts say he is talking specifically about South Korea. Is South Korea really not contributing enough to its defense, or is Trump trying to accomplish something else?
Well, it depends on who you ask, I guess, if the question is South Korea contributing enough to its defense. South Korea views this as they are contributing about half of the cost of U.S. military presence in South Korea. Donald Trump seems to use different figures. Donald Trump, at his rally in Florida, used a figure of $5 billion per year, apparently referring to how much the U.S. military presence in South Korea costs. But analysts have said it costs much, much less than that, maybe $1 to $2 billion. So really it depends on how you're framing this. But then again, there's just the broader question of when Donald Trump says things like this at a political rally, is he really sending a message to South Korea, or is he sending a message to his supporters there at that rally who want to see him as being tough? This is really a question of how long Donald Trump can continue to shrug off these increasing North Korean provocations.
That was Bill Gallo, VOA's correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul. In related news, North Korea's ambassador to the United Nations has defended his country's human rights record. Ambassador Han Tae-song said North Korea's government had made a devoted effort for the good of the people. He added that human rights violations in whatever form are intolerable. The North Korean diplomat went on to compare economic sanctions placed on his country for its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile activities to crimes. North Korea's human rights record was discussed today as part of the United Nations Universal Periodic Review, a process under the Human Rights Council in which member states declare what they have done to improve the human rights situation in their country. A committee in the United States Senate has ordered Donald Trump Jr., son of President Donald Trump, to appear to answer questions related to testimony he gave in 2017. Media reports say the Senate Intelligence Committee wants Trump Jr. to speak about information provided by President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. Cohen is currently serving a jail term for fraud and lying to investigators. The committee issued the subpoena yesterday. Mike Hempen of the Associated Press has this.
Cohen told a House committee in February that he briefed Trump Jr. approximately 10 times about a plan to build a Trump Tower in Moscow before the 2016 election. Trump Jr. told the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2017 he was only peripherally aware of the proposal. People familiar with the subpoena, speaking on condition of anonymity, say the committee wants Trump Jr. to answer questions about his 2017 testimony to the panel. It's the first known subpoena of a member of President Trump's immediate family. It's unclear if Trump Jr. will comply with the subpoena. A person close to the president's eldest son says Trump Jr. has been cooperating by producing documents and answering written questions. Mike Hempen, Washington.
Among the top stories in the world, the United Nations-supported Prime Minister of Libya is on a four-nation European tour to gain support for his embattled government. Officials in Pakistan say Islamic organizations have agreed to put some 30,000 religious schools under supervision of the Ministry of Education. And French unions are holding strikes and protests against deep job cuts and changes to France's public sector, called for by French President Emmanuel Macron. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com and our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. European Union officials say they aim to continue trading with Iran, although the United States has placed new sanctions on the country. Speaking at an EU meeting in Romania, EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini said today that the EU remains committed to the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. Mogherini said, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was a matter of security for the EU and the world. However, EU officials have voiced concern about Iran's most recent threat to restore some nuclear development activities and partially withdraw from the agreement. The U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement last year, reimposing economic restrictions on the country because it said the deal did little to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Yesterday, the U.S. warned European banks, investors, and businesses against taking part in so-called special purpose vehicles to avoid U.S. sanctions. AP's Charles de Ledesma has more.
The EU says it will continue trading with the country despite U.S. sanctions, but they note with great concern statements from Iran concerning its commitments to the nuclear deal. The joint EU message came as the bloc struggles to preserve the 2015 accord. Officials say they regret the reimposition of sanctions by the U.S. and remain determined to continue pursuing efforts to enable the continuation of legitimate trade with Iran. To this end, they've set up a complicated barter-type system in an attempt to evade American sanctions. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Pope Francis introduced a law today governing the reporting and investigation of clerical sexual abuse. The action comes as an answer to victims who have long called on the leadership of the Roman Catholic Church to deal with the crisis. The experimental law takes effect on June 1st. It will be re-examined following a 3-year trial period. All 415,000 Catholic priests and 660 nuns will be required to report sexual abuse and cover-ups by their superiors to church officials. The church law provides protections to people who make accusations and requires the church to implement a system to receive complaints privately. The law is the latest effort by Francis to respond to the global problem of clerical sex abuse and cover-up scandals that have harmed the credibility of Catholic leaders and the papacy. It also provides new legal guidelines for U.S. bishops to use as they prepare to adopt accountability measures next month. An attack against a U.S.-funded international relief organization in Afghanistan yesterday killed at least 9 people and wounded more than 20 others. Officials say Taliban insurgents attacked the offices of Counterpart International, which is a partner of the U.S. Agency for International Development. The Taliban said the organization was targeted because it was involved in what it called harmful Western activities. VOA's Afghan service spoke with the president of the Counterpart International, Ann Huddock, at the organization's headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, near Washington. She says the group, which focuses on gender equality and social inclusion for marginalized groups, such as those with disabilities, is nonpartisan and aims to help people improve their lives. Huddock says the group staff in Kabul is all safe and says the attack won't stop their work.
This is our commitment to Afghanistan. This is our commitment to civil society engagement around the world, not just in Afghanistan. We've been working for more than 54 years to support civilians like the innocent people who were killed today, to help them take control of their lives and to make a better future for themselves. That commitment is unending.
Huddock said her organization has worked in Afghanistan for more than 12 years and has never been attacked before. She condemned the attack.
What I can say to you is this, is that the senseless violence that happened today has no place in a civilized world. And it has nothing at all to do with Islam. That what we are seeing today is a senseless act in the midst of Ramadan, one of the holiest months. And so for us, this makes it particularly egregious.
Last week in Qatar, Taliban representatives and U.S. negotiators began a 6th round of peace talks aimed at ending the 17-year war in Afghanistan. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
China says it has made all necessary preparations if the United States imposes a new set of tariffs on Chinese goods. China's chief trade negotiator is arriving in Washington for another round of talks aimed at ending the trade dispute between the two sides. Vice Premier Liu He and President Xi Jinping's top economic advisor will sit down with U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin today. Tomorrow, tariffs on Chinese goods increase from 10% to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. U.S. President Donald Trump set the Friday deadline to raise tariffs after the U.S. accused China of reneging on commitments made during months of talks to end the trade dispute earlier this week. Trump said yesterday that he would be happy to maintain tariffs on Chinese imports. He added that China would be mistaken if it hopes to negotiate trade later with a Democratic presidential administration. Chinese Commerce Ministry spokesman Gao Feng told reporters in Beijing today that China will not bow to any pressure and warned it has the determination and ability to defend its own interests. With the growing populations demanding more food and climate change affecting traditional farming practices, the race is on to find new ways to produce food. The Disruptive Agricultural Technology Challenge and conference recently took place in Nairobi, Kenya. The two-day event ignited talks from global experts and many of Kenya's most promising DAT innovators and various stakeholders. 15 of the DAT entrepreneurs were selected to receive funding and support from the World Bank Group and also were invited to join the Million Farmers Digital Disruption Platform. My colleague Kim Lewis spoke with Parmesh Shah, Global Lead for Rural Livelihoods and Agricultural Jobs at the World Bank, about the challenge and what it means for Kenya's agricultural startups.
Kenya has many innovators in fintech and agtech space. We are supporting large program, supporting about 1 million farmers to increase their productivity, market access, and other services. And we wanted this challenge to really get the innovators in the Kenya space who have been working on these innovations to work with these 1 million farmers who we are supporting in various counties of Kenya. So this challenge was to really identify the best innovators who will work on the 1 million farmer platform, which we are launching in Kenya now. So it's basically a digital platform, disruptive technology platform, where innovators will work with farmers and farmer organizations, which are being supported by the World Bank.
How important is it for Kenya's farmers to have access to new technology?
It's very important because the Kenya agriculture, although has been growing in some parts, but the productivity increases have been in single digits, and a number of smallholders particularly have not been able to access the latest technologies. So the Kenya wants to have food security and also exploit the opportunities on various commodities which Kenya is producing in terms of national and global markets. This access technology is very important. But access technology is not only about productivity. It is about accessing market opportunities, accessing directly the opportunities to sell their produce to various buyers who are wanting commodities from Kenya but are not able to link with smallholders. So the challenge is very important in that respect.
Can you tell me just a little bit about some of the competition, those that came out on top, some of the entrepreneurs, like what were they offering to the farmers? What type of technology?
So there are two types of innovators who really, I think, came out on this. I think most of these technologies are enabling digital access to services. To give you an example, that we have some entrepreneurs who have provided advisory services to farmers, which is based on satellite data and a lot of other data which is being collected from farmers through sensors and other kinds of things. And so the farmers get just-in-time services about sowing, about availability of inputs, availability of fertilizers. Then there are many people who want to deliver these services to farmers in the last mile. So some of the innovators are developing mechanisms by which farmers will get courier services for delivering fertilizers at their doorstep at absolutely the right time based on the demand which has been collected through digital aggregation of farmers. The other things are related with access to markets. Many of the innovators have digitally aggregated the information from farmers and have related to the key buyers so that they get forward digital contracts from the companies which are wanting to buy this produce from smallholders, and then also develop simple logistic solutions wherein the farmers get information on SMS on how to sell their produce and when to sell their produce. And the money then gets transferred in their accounts for the M-Pesa. So it's like developing a very seamless kind of flow between the sellers and buyers so that the farmers are able to get almost 15 to 20% higher prices in one season.
That was Parma Shah, Global Lead for Rural Livelihoods and Agricultural Jobs at the World Bank, speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis. United States lawmakers have praised Taiwan as a good ally during an event at the Capitol yesterday. Relations between the U.S. and mainland China have been strained because of continuing trade disputes. Critics are also concerned about China's unwillingness to democratize and the threat of illiberal influences as it reaches more regions of the world. Wednesday's event commemorated the 40th anniversary of the enactment of the Taiwan Relations Act. The public law provides a framework for continuing bilateral ties after the U.S. establishment of official diplomatic relations with Beijing in 1979. Lawmakers of both parties praised relations between Washington and Taipei. Republican House Member Scott Perry of Pennsylvania said, "We have to stick with the folks that are most like us and that we are most like." Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi also attended the event, which she described as a celebration. You have been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and engineer, Sidrak Franklin. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Be sure to enjoy your day.